Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Following Caesar, From Rome to Constantinople, The Pathways That Planted the Seeds of Empire, by John Cahey. Narrated by Tom Perkins. Introduction. Caesar. Let me have men about me that are fat, sleek-headed men, and such as sleep o' nights. Yond Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous. William Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. This was an eagerly awaited journey, designed to follow as closely as possible the ancient routes of three Roman roads, the Via Appia and the Via Traiana in Italy, and the Via Egnatia across the Balkans and through four countries. I would follow several travelers, most prominently Julius Caesar, on his way to wage war with his one-time son-in-law and lost friend, Pompey. This three-month-long journey had to be launched despite the reality that a pandemic was roaring its way around the globe. After a year's delay waiting for the proper vaccines and for key countries, such as Italy and Greece, to reopen after requiring all their citizens to isolate, the trip could finally be planned for the fall of 2021. In crossing a handful of borders, 8 COVID tests were required, some from pharmacies within 2 days of crossing, others at border stations performed by customs officials poking long-stemmed cotton-tipped sticks through car windows. Paperwork had to be presented at each stop so officials could track me down if anyone I was around during these transits came down with the disease. It was unnerving knowing that despite 2 vaccinations and a booster, I could still get sick and be forcibly isolated, unable to travel to do my work. But the tests, some costing heavy fees, some free at a couple of borders, were always negative. Masks were worn everywhere, especially in Italy, and businesses were rigorous in checking this American's CDC proof of vaccination card. Only one uninformed restaurant worker, after I had visited dozens of such establishments over 3 months, refused to acknowledge the CDC card and turned me away. Fortunately, in the tiny village of Nemi, south of Rome, there was another restaurant nearby that understood the car was all that American travelers could have. And its food was excellent. We foreigners did not have access to the digital green pass system available to Italians. These hurdles aside, the trip worked out well, with one major exception. Albania, which has a nice selection of preserved Via Egnatia segments, was open to travelers mid-pandemic during the beginning of this journey. In early November, the plan was to go by ferry with my Brindisi friend, Danny Vitali. He had offered to use his Italian-registered vehicle during a 3-day visit, since my French rental car was not allowed in that country. That mobility would allow us to visit the battlefield near Dyrrhachium, today the port city of Durres, where Pompey defeated Caesar and chased him into Greece. Then, in neighboring Greece, at the Battle of Pharsalus, Caesar eventually destroyed his rival. Our plan was to make our base in Elbasan, a city in the middle of this section of Albania. In Roman times, when the province was known as Illyricum, the city harbored a big way station, a mansion along the Via Egnatia that eventually grew into a rather sizable city. The drive across this west-east section, Durres to the North Macedonian border, would take only 3 hours, so distances are short and easily doable in a series of day trips in the time we had set aside. But the pandemic in that eastern Balkan nation grew, and our tickets were canceled. The ferry service let only commercial truckers on board. Commerce must still be allowed to flow, pandemic or not. Tourists, even working travelers, were blocked. Maybe it was a blessing. After 3 months of travel, I never tested positive in the handful of tests I took. Perhaps going to Albania would have been my downfall, and Danny and I would have been forced into isolation for 10 days, a disaster for both our schedules. For this book's purposes, I have chosen, out of habit, to use B.C. and A.D. for ancient dates. They correspond to B.C.E. and C.E. used by other writers. For the 3-month journey, I have told the story in a sequence starting in Rome and ending in Brindisi for the Via Appia. Then I jumped across the Adriatic to North Macedonia, down into Greece, and on to Istanbul in Turkey. many places were visited out of sequence. To keep things simple, I wrote about them as if they were taken in order. For example, I wrote about the Egnatia segments to Philippi that I had missed my first time through and then experienced on my return trip from Turkey. And I wrote about Sinuessa, Minturno, and Itri as I was returning to Rome. Discovery is the crucial element of a journey like this, and I would sometimes learn about places and their roles along the Via Appia and the Via Egnatia after I had passed through and was headed elsewhere. Such places were worth a return trip, and those visits became key elements in the story. Last, I visited places near the Via Appia, but not on it. Places such as Bari on the Adriatic coast, and Troia and Herdonia farther inland. These were towns and ruins on the Via Traiana, a road ordered built by Emperor Trajan 300 years after the Via Appia. And I had longed to see the ancient ruins of Cannae, overlooking the plain where Hannibal handily defeated a massive Roman army. Since Hannibal had driven his Carthaginians along portions of the Via Appia in southern Italy and is written about elsewhere, I felt Cannae was important. And, during a short drive away from the Via Appia, I visited the Golfo di Pozzuoli, where the towns of Baccoli, Baia, and Pozzuoli are located. Pozzuoli, known in ancient times as Puteoli, is where St. Paul came ashore to face his Roman captors. This bay was a common spot where travelers, diplomats, and armies would disembark from ships and head, on secondary roads, to join the Via Appia at Capua or Sinuessa to begin a journey to either Rome or points southeast. All these places are a cherished part in this story. But to keep the sequences in order, I tell their stories in the final chapter. Of course, an undertaking of a book of this magnitude could not have been accomplished without a lot of help. I met most of these good folks while traveling, simply by asking a lodgings host if they knew someone who was an expert or who could help me solve a particular problem. Almost none of them were lined up in advance. They fell generously into place as I went from town to town and were eager and willing to help. It is a long list, and I wish I could describe in detail how each contributed. And I am grateful to the website Poetry in Translation for granting permission to use its translations of the Roman poet Horace's Satires and the ancient writer Virgil's Georgics. 1. Born out of necessity. Appia Longarum Territua Regina Viarum, Queen of Long Highways. Roman poet Statius. It begins like most things. There is a need or a sense of preservation, or, simply put, cold ambition takes over and cannot be squelched. The people who became Romans, traditionally in the 8th century BC, were first interested only in preserving their hilltops. Then, over a few hundred years, as their wooden and stone huts evolved into humble brick structures and then into columned superstructures, they climbed down those slopes, commingled with other nearby hilltop dwellers, and after the rule of at least four kings, created a republic. From that republic's earliest years, Romans elected consuls who became military leaders and then began looking beyond their hill-lined valley with the Tiber River running through it. There were other people, some friendly and some not so, elsewhere in this hinterland beyond that famous river that was named after a mythical river god of the earliest Romans, Tiberinus. This waterway, the second longest on the Italian peninsula, was a natural transportation route that also provided a line where foes squared off on opposite banks, battling for control of rudimentary bridges. To keep from being taken over, Romans had to build, over time, successive walls, ever expanding their city outward and absorbing those cross-river rivals. Eventually, early Roman soldiers, cobbled together in rough, barely organized gangs, needed to look beyond their river valley to protect their still small city from interlopers. The most critical threat, once the Latins absorbed neighboring Etruscans into their society and subdued local populations, was a people to the south and east known as Samnites, who occupied Italy's central highlands, which are now part of Italy's Campania region. For a half century, from 341 to 290 BC, roughly more than two centuries before the birth of Julius Caesar, the The Romans fought the Samnites and their allies in three wars. The first war occurred when the people of Capua, located to the south and east of Rome, appealed to the Romans for help against these powerful invaders. The war ended in a treaty, and Capua was firmly under Roman banners. Then, Rome created colonies in Samnite territory, initiating a second war, in which Romans lost critical battles before reversing their fortunes and securing another treaty. In this struggle, Rome learned valuable lessons in military organization and tactics from the well-armed Samnites. It adopted a warrior philosophy that served it through its republican years and well into the empire. Of course, a third war was inevitable. A much improved and better disciplined Roman army defeated Samnites, Umbrians, and Etruscans in a battle in central Italy, followed in 291 BC by a Roman victory over the Samnites in Aquilonia, a town still using that ancient name, and established the colony of Venusia, today's Venosa, which figures later in our story. Again, a treaty. This time, Rome, still fated to fight other battles on the peninsula against a variety of different peoples in its efforts to unify Italy, emerged as a dominant player. The Samnite Wars are critical to understanding why Roman roads, such as the Via Appia and the Via Egnatia to the east of the peninsula, became so important in the thousand-year history of the Republic-turned-Empire. It was during this multi-layered conflict that one of the earliest roads, and certainly the most famous, the Via Appia, emerged. And while figuring mightily in defeating the Samnites, its success eventually spawned a series of roads all over Europe, North Africa, east to the Black Sea, and into the Middle East. And they all led to Rome. Appius Claudius Caicus enters our story principally during the Second Samnite War. A writer and political leader, he had to put in time as a military tribune if he wanted to be elected consul. That conflict gave him such a moment. Can we imagine him, perhaps ensconced in his tent near a potential battlefield, wondering how a large army can make its way through a nearly roadless, muddy environment, hacking through forests, moving quickly with enough supplies to last it through a long march and major battles, and to allow reserves to arrive in the nick of time? No matter how the idea popped into his head, Appius saw the need for a mostly level, mostly straight road that allowed heavy traffic to move perhaps 25 miles a day. Such a road would be hewn from volcanic stones, hard enough to keep armies, wagons, and horses out of the mud, and to quickly meet and engage an enemy. Some Romans opposed it. They worried that the enemy could use such a road to do the same to them. But Appius, newly appointed censor beginning in 312 BC, got its first segment built within 5 years and lived long enough to see it extended all the way to friendly Capua, some 130 miles from Rome, by 307 BC. It began somewhere near the entrance to the Roman Forum, across from the spot where the Colosseum was built a few hundred years later. The exact spot of its actual beginning could be beneath a nearby roundabout. An article in National Geographic reports that to discover its beginning, the Ministry of Cultural Heritage has been digging out small deep strips of pavement, so far unsuccessfully. At any rate, it moved from the Forum area, mostly in a straight line, to the faraway village of Anxur, now known as Terracina. From there it shifted slightly inland to a place called Fondi, then headed back toward the coast, passing through Itri, and after a stretch along the Mediterranean it turned southeastward to inland Capua. The name of Itri, a village that figures later in this story, could have been derived from the Latin word iter, which means route or way. Appropriate, because the early Via Appia, its ancient stones covered by modern pavement, still flows through its historic center. Within another half century, with the Samnites out of the picture, the Via Appia, referred to as Regina Viarum, or Queen of Roads, was pushed to Beneventum, Venusia, Tarentum, and on to the port city of Brundisium, arriving there about 191 BC. These places, with the Via Appia's stones still under modern roads and often below farmers' fields, live on today as Benevento, Venosa, Taranto, and Brindisi. Some researchers, studying how surveyors got the Via Appia so straight from south of Rome to Terracina, believe the ancients, by citing uncertain stars like the divine twins Castor and Pollux to lay out portions of the route, wanted to appease gods who were considered allies. Such a function would be important for a military made up of true believers. Real or not, the researchers have surveyed the route based on star alignments that were present in the skies above south-central Italy 2,000 years ago. Castor and Pollux do figure into it. It is up to conjecture whether the religious aspect was mentioned strictly to motivate Roman soldiers who, when not engaged in local battles but still being paid, would be charged with surveying, engineering, stone quarrying, and other hard physical tasks. Slaves taken from conquered villages along the route could be used, but Roman soldiers did much of the work. We moderns can imagine how this road looked from viewing photographs of one of the ancient sweeps open to public view. A popular section is a few miles south of the Roman Forum area where modern roads overlie the beginning of that ancient road. This section is preserved in the Parco Regionale dell'Appia Antica, an archaeological park of nearly 8,500 acres and 10 miles long. Within it are preserved stretches of original stones glistening in the sunlight, with shadows of leaves dancing across their basalt surfaces. That's the way the road started out in the time of Appius, pushing through the gate of Rome's early defensive Servian Wall. Later, another gate for the Aurelian Wall was built over the route. The writer A.J. Langeth paints a lovely description of the original road's composition as it made its way to Capua under Appius's direction. Near Rome itself, Appius built the road with blocks of gray basalt, but as it wound past cypress and pine trees and across the Pontine marshes, his road became only gravel and, at its farther points, it was no more than a dirt footpath amid weeds and flowers. The road, of course, was improved over the decades and, most principally, in a few centuries later by the Emperor Trajan, who adjusted its route here and there. Those volcanic stones were supplemented by large, hardened slabs from local quarries cut out of nearby hills. At Anxur, Terracina, for example, the original road steeply ascended a high promontory where the Temple of Jupiter Anxur still dominates the skyline. This routing, which extended toward Fondi a few miles away, ignored the original concept of a straight-level highway. But Trajan's engineers figured out a way to bring its course back down to level ground and resume its southeastwardly run toward Capua. They made room for it by cutting back a high, massive stone wall at the sea's edge. Near this Campanian city, now with the modern name of Santa Maria Capua Vetere, the Via Appia met up with a slightly earlier Roman road, the Via Latina. It doesn't have the fame of its bigger, slightly younger sister. Modern highways don't follow much of its route, although a modern portion of a rail line between Rome and Naples is built over a stretch. While it was not built to Appius Claudius Caicus's high standards, it likely was improved over time. But the Via Appia, a quicker course from Rome to ancient Capua, was preferred. Today, the route is generally followed by Italy's highway Strada Statale 7, or SS7. It is generally known as Via Appia Nuova, new, when it closely parallels the ancient road's route. It appears on maps and road signs simply either as Via Appia or with Antica tacked on when modern pavements cover the same alignment as the ancient Roman road. Another road that captures our interest, the Via Egnatia, was begun in 145 BC, nearly 170 years after the start of the Via Appia. It too was built to high Roman standards. It originally ran from the ancient Illyricum port of Dyrrhachium, now modern Durres in Albania, through the southwest corner of North Macedonia to Thessaloniki in Greece and farther east to Philippi. Eventually, it was pushed all the way to Byzantium, which later was named Constantinople in honor of Constantine the Great. We know it as Istanbul. Over the centuries, the Via Egnatia provided a route for armies marching back and forth across the Balkan Peninsula. During the Roman era, St. Paul and his companion St. Silas, in circa AD 50, traveled along the route between their landing at Neapolis, now the Greek city of Kavala, to the ancient city of Philippi where he preached. The two eventually followed the Via Egnatia to Thessaloniki, where Paul left the road and was spirited to Athens for his protection from angry Thessalonian Jews who objected to him preaching in their synagogue. Eventually, accompanied by St. Luke, he would sail to Italy, coming ashore at Puteoli, now modern Pozzuoli. He and his party followed local pathways for a few miles up to the Via Appia, likely joining it near the ancient village of Sinuessa, and followed it to Rome, where legend says St. Paul was eventually beheaded. Silas's fate is not known, but he was evidently spared, as was the chronicler Luke. The Via Egnatia, sometimes left to fall into disrepair, other times wonderfully maintained, was ruled over by a number of Balkan-based powers, principally the Eastern Roman Empire that emerged when the Roman Empire was divided into West and East in AD 395. It also was known as the Byzantine Empire, which lasted until 1453, when Constantinople fell to the Ottoman Empire. St. Paul aside, for centuries pilgrims from Europe followed the Via Egnatia to Constantinople and then traveled across the Bosporus Strait to the Holy Land on other Roman roads. Today, modern travelers can journey along much of the ancient Egnatia's nearly 700-mile original length, almost double the 360-mile-long Appia from the Adriatic coastline to where the ancient road ended a few dozen feet from Istanbul's mosque, the Hagia Sophia. And any discussion of these two roads that connect Rome to the eastern edge of its empire must include Emperor Trajan's great building feat, the Via Traiana. It was begun in AD 109 and, leaving the Via Appia at Benevento, it followed a southeastward route to the coastal city of Bari, and then down the coast to Brindisi. Ironically, the Via Traiana between Benevento and Brindisi is 2 miles longer at 205 miles compared to the 203 miles of the Via Appia through the interior. The Via Appia, despite its reputation for running straight and level, has numerous hills and other difficult terrain to cross south of Benevento to as far as Venosa. Taking Trajan's mostly flat coastal route saved travelers a day. With traditional Roman road-building ingenuity, the Via Traiana tied together earlier footpaths that were mostly level and ran close to the sea. It ran southeast to Bari, turned south, and connected with the Via Appia just outside of Brindisi's walls. Today, archaeologists know that, at the height of empire, some 29 roads led out of Rome. The Via Appia and its predecessor by just a few decades, the Via Latina, were just the beginning. An engineering website, Interesting Engineering, reports that 372 roads connected the empire's 113 provinces. These provinces extended from Britain to Mesopotamia in the Middle East and from the Danube River to Spain and North Africa. These paved roads, built primarily for military reasons, covered 50,000 miles. What kinds of ancient building techniques kept these roads and dozens of others like them functioning around the inland sea known as the Mediterranean for more than 2,000 years? After all, this incredible road-building process continued for more than 700 Republican and Empire years. And they continued to serve shifting populations, other empires that came and went, and different governments for centuries beyond. Their heavily engineered construction was, of course, a marvel. We can look at stylized drawings that show the various layers of road design and assume that this was consistent in nearly all Roman road building. It wasn't. For example, Roman road pavements depended on the kind of stone that was available in each local area. Builders certainly could not transport to farther-flung sites a massive volume of surface stone like that used immediately south of Rome's historic center. Also, high groundwater levels and swamps in some segments might mean the trenches holding the different layers would not need to be as deep as they might elsewhere, or that they would require more maintenance as the decades passed. This said, the process of building the Via Appia and other roads in favorable terrain generally involved digging a trench 20 to 23 feet wide enough for legions with men marching six abreast, and up to 6.5 feet deep, or at least until bedrock could be reached. A lime mortar would line this trench to even out imperfections, and rocks small enough to be hand-carried would cover this substructure. On top of these, a more gravel-like layer of stones would be spread to facilitate water drainage, and above that, to a depth of nearly a foot toward the road's edges and nearly 1.5 feet in the middle, gravel, coarse sand or earthen fragments, and lime mortar would be spread. Did the creation of this middle hump, which was often higher in very wet areas, and obviously used to send rainwater tumbling to the sides and into stone-lined drainage channels, give rise to the English term highway? Finally, pavement stones would be laid, many cut to fit snugly against their neighbors. Researchers tell us that miniature bridges were placed over small streams and paved fords provided passage over shallow spots in rivers. Wider rivers, some of which 2,000 years later are mere trickles, were spanned by wooden bridges that eventually were replaced by great stone bridges. Evidence exists in foundations and broken arches. A few are still used by modern traffic and farm machinery in isolated rural areas. One researcher writes that unavoidable marshes and swamps were traversed by wooden pontoons, and bridges were built atop those structures. And sometimes water-carrying viaducts acted as long bridges. All this work created structures and roadways that lasted for centuries, and it told potential rebellious upstarts that Roman legions could arrive quickly. That knowledge was often sufficient to keep the peace. One other aspect of this building process, in addition to running through existing villages, was the creation along the routes of new settlements and major military camps. Inns were established for travelers either on foot or on horseback. Maps clearly show the routes of these ancient roads through the modern world of southern Italy and the Balkans. Some brief sections are well established and preserved, allowing the visitor a quick glance or a hiker a pleasant journey over stones that have been trod upon for centuries. Other sections are hidden 3 or 4 feet below modern roads. Still others are buried below farmers' fields or covered over by modern homes and businesses. Historians and archaeologists can only speculate where they are. These roads call out to be seen and followed, at least as far as knowledge and weather allow. Towns and villages that still exist were created as way stations to serve armies, travelers, pilgrims, and dispatch riders who, carrying messages from the empire's distant corners to emperors, needed fresh horses every 20 or 30 miles. And many no longer exist except in our imagination, sheltered in protected archaeological sites that, among piles of stones and fallen columns, can only hint at a magnificent past. There is the then and the now that must be seen and absorbed. It's a journey of more than 1,000 modern miles, or 1,070 Roman miles, and it must begin in Rome and end in Istanbul. 2. A beginning. Leaving great Rome for Aricia, a modest inn received me. The rhetorician Heliodorus was with me, most learned of Greeks. To Forum Appii, then, crammed with bargemen and stingy innkeepers. We took this lazily in 2 days, though keener travelers than us take only one. The Appians easier taken slow. Roman poet Horace. In the early fall of 2021, as the poet Horace did roughly 2,060 years before, I left Great Rome for Aricia, today's Aricia, a mere 20 miles distant, following as closely as possible his route, known today as the Strada Statale 7, or SS7. He knew the stones beneath his feet only as the Via Appia, which, beginning in 312 BC, was hammered across wide plains, chiseled through valleys, cut through deep woods, and built up along the muddy edges of marshes almost 300 years before his journey, likely undertaken sometime between 40 and 37 BC. He doesn't go into much detail about why he was making the journey, but history tells us that it was part of a diplomatic mission ordered by Octavian, the future Emperor Augustus, to help mend his tenuous political relationship with his former co-ruler Mark Antony. With a diverse assortment of friends and fellow diplomats, Horace traveled along the Via Appia's well-laid-out route, leaving it at Beneventum, where his party turned eastward and followed a rough collection of undeveloped and soggy footpaths to the Adriatic coast. At the tiny fishing village of Bartium, they headed south toward their destination, the port city of Brundisium in southeast Italy. More than a century later, under the Emperor Trajan, this muddy divergence from the Via...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?